Some more formal definitions that will allow you to, even though you may not be the one calling up a particular application, you'll be able to understand whether a result that anyone would present makes sense, where they've done enough of a job to guarantee that the solution they are obtaining is the fine one, is the correct one, and all in all will be part of this numerical analysis techniques that we're introducing that it will come handy both at the moment, at the point of you being the one looking for a numerical solution or just assessing where a numerical solution makes sense or not. So I'll just revisit a few of the things we said yesterday, and then we're going to advance rather quickly through a number of concepts. And because everything is sufficiently clear and it's all available in the notes, I'm going to rely on you taking a look on your own as well at the notes independently. And if you have any questions, let me know. And let me just stress this again. Hopefully this is going to be as interactive as possible. Just keep stopping me and asking questions for whatever you may want to ask. So let me just, for simplicity, we're going to concentrate again on the wave equation. We're going to introduce a few things, and slowly we're going to keep scaling up towards more and more generical statement that at the end of the day you're going to see we're not even going to be talking about an equation in particular, but just a generic equation with some operator and then trying to assess things. But so let's start at this level first. We're thinking we're dealing with the simplest possible equation, and because this equation is rather simple, what we're going to try to do for the most part is use explicitly that we know and we could write the solution in just a second for the most general solution of this equation. We're going to treat everything as if it were a system that a priori we really don't know what the solution might be, just because that's going to be the generic situation where you're going to be trying to use numerical techniques to obtain the answers. So we imagine that we have one PDE equation, but as I said, this we could have many at the same time, and they may be coupled and highly nonlinear, but let's just concentrate on this one. We imagine that we give these initial conditions, and as we said, we need to give two initial conditions because we're dealing with the second order equation. And we can introduce the definitions that we introduced yesterday for the time derivative of the field, which we define pi, and then later on we can also introduce this p, which was the gradient, the special derivative of this function phi. We're also going to think that eventually we're going to put boundary conditions, and we'll discuss this later on. And we just want to first discuss how to deal with this problem. So just the basic framework, this we discussed yesterday, but let me just go over it again to fix ideas. We imagine that we have time discretized with a number of time levels, all equispaced in time, so every two slices of time are separated by some constant value delta time, which we denote by dt. We're assuming that we start at t equal to 0, therefore then this n goes from 0 all the way to whatever maximum limit of time steps we might want to take, and we denote this every level by the t upper index n. We're going to discretize in space in the box that extends from a left boundary being 0 and a right boundary being 1. So we are going to denote the positions in the grid that x sub j, where this subindex j denotes which particular point on our discretized lattice we're talking about. And we're going to assume that there is a uniform grid space in between in that grid, so any two points are separated by delta x. And so any point is related to delta x and j in this way. So j, if j is 1, then we have a 0 here. We start, that's the left boundary. And we go all the way to capital J. We have j minus 1 times delta x. And once we define this delta x, we will know that we go all the way to 1. So for instance, if we define delta x to be 1 divided by this capital J minus 1, okay, if we evaluate the last point being capital J here, we will have j minus 1 times delta x, which is 1 over j minus 1. So we're going to have the numerator simplifying the denominator. As a result, x evaluated at capital J is just 1. And we'll see our field, which the one we're trying to obtain, as just the discrete set of values, having values at different time levels and at all the space grid points that we have. And something that we mentioned yesterday, and we'll introduce some criteria for this later on, is we're going to choose this relationship between the time stepping, the distance in between time levels, and the distance between grid points, tightly related linearly by just a factor. And this factor is called the Courant number, or the Courant factor. And we'll discuss why this in this way, and how different equations might have different values or different relations as we discuss stability of the implementation. But for the moment, let's assume that we're going to keep it linear. And the important thing is that now this tells us that the spacing in time is directly related to the spacing in space. And so we have only one number that we have to worry about, which is the h, or this delta x. If we change delta x, we also change delta t. And so by changing this delta x, immediately all the discretization gets either finer or coarser by changing a single number. And that's convenient in what we'll discuss later as far as assessing the error of the solution. So this pictorially is how we see our grid as having discrete points in space and discrete levels in time. And this is what we're going to try to use. And for simplicity, you know, just to avoid writing delta x and delta t, we're just going to imagine that the spacing is given by h. And we're going to use this throughout. So we discussed one particular way of going about trying to implement this equation, which was to write the second time derivative using these three levels, the second space derivative using these three levels, and we then have this very basic stencil for updating the value of the function, obtaining it here, given that we know the three values at the previous level and these values at the past level. And this is one of the things we mentioned about the finite difference approximations, and was one of the reasons we introduced it as being one method, or a method, that preserves the locality of the computation. We really don't care what the value of the function is here. The only thing we need to worry about is this very local cell, and that's all that it matters in updating that point. Yes? Right, so if you got, right, so you generalize it, so instead of this is space, so then we're going to have another point here, another point behind the screen, and then they are in the third dimension. Okay, so this was our first technique, or the first discretization that we introduced, which was to realize that this combination in time, keeping the space position fixed, gives an approximation to the second time derivative, the analytical second time derivative evaluated at n, at the level n, and the space point j, with some error. And using the Taylor approximation, we can actually tell that the leading contribution to the error in assigning this combination to the second time derivative is given by that, which is the four time derivative of the function phi multiply it by delta t square. So slowly we're beginning to look ahead of how we're going to be analyzing errors in general, because here we can compute what the error is. But for the moment, we're going to be content in saying, okay, this goes like delta t square. We remember that delta t is linearly related to delta x. So if this scales like delta t square, it's also scaling like delta x square. And we call delta x h, so we are at this level, we're content or happy to say the error goes like h squared. This one, same thing. Now this is what we have in space. We then, by the same analysis, say this is second order approximation to the second continuous derivative of the function. Right? And we know, again, that the error scales like h squared. Because our equation is the second time derivative of phi l phi equal to the second time derivative of the second space derivative of the phi l phi, we can replace that by this expression for the time derivatives, this expression for the space derivative, and we know we're making an overall error, which is of order h squared. So this is the new equation we're solving. It's no longer our original equation, which, let me just write it here again. This is the equation we wanted to solve. This is the equation that we will solve. We know that has an order h squared, and our goal now is to be able to guarantee that this approximation will give us something that is consistent and accurate, and understand what are the possible family of our possible solutions that we obtain here, and how they relate to this one. And as we'll see and discuss later, we're going to have a much richer structure in here. There are many more possible solutions contained in that equation than the one contained here. And if we do things correctly, the main solution we're going to obtain actually will give us a good approximation to this solution to the problem we really wanted to solve. And so this is some of the things we want to discuss. But we mentioned that we want to make sure that we completely specify the problem. We are now dealing with a problem that has boundaries. So this is J equal to 0, and this is J equal to capital J. And then say this n equal to 0, and n equal n some upper level here. So let's suppose that we use as boundary conditions the fact that the field phi will be identically 0 at these two ends. So we just clamp the field there. Again, always we need to make sure that we understand the equation at the analytical level. At the analytical level, we have a second order equation. We said we needed two pieces of information at the initial data to be able to evolve forward. We also need two pieces of information for boundaries. If we have a second order equation, you need two pieces of information. So this always, the counting has to be consistent. So we need two boundary conditions, and we're going to use, for this example, boundary conditions being the field at the left and the field at the right equals 0. When we do that, when we're introducing boundaries, we're introducing the physics. We have to be very careful what we do. Let me just pictorially imagine this scenario. Suppose you're solving things in a box that is this small, and you want the solution at a very late time. So exaggerating things a little bit, notice just how much, if you just do some intuitive kind of reasoning, this is the initial data that you provide that has this extent, but the boundary condition will have all this extent if you want the solution here. That means if you don't do the right job at the boundaries, you're going to render the initial data that you might have worked very hard to obtain completely useless. That means the influence of the initial data may be completely washed out by inappropriate boundary conditions that you might have chosen. So you have to be as careful with the boundary conditions as you are with the initial data, depending on the particular application you may have in mind. Okay, so also notice that in that particular scheme, even though we quickly change to discussing a different scheme, this is the cell we have. So at every given point that we want to obtain, we need values at the previous level, at three points at the previous level, and one point at two levels below, which means if I want to start iterating my equation, I can only start with level 2, because level 1 and level 0, I have to give by hand. And this is just consistent with saying, because I have a second order equation, I need two pieces of information. And so we can now turn, as we said yesterday, this equation, if I imagine that I have at any given level the two previous levels known, the only unknown quantity in this equation is sitting here. Everything else should be known. And so I can solve for the value that phi j has at n plus 1, obtaining something that has this shape, where I have defined, remember this lambda, remember the lambda was this quantity that related delta t and delta x. So lambda is delta t divided by delta x. We had a delta x dividing here, delta x squared dividing here, that produced the second order derivative operator, the second spatial derivative operator of phi. We had a delta t squared in here. We bring it to the other term, and so I end up having delta t squared divided by delta x squared, and that is this quantity lambda. And so this is now what we see is a structure that is generic in this finite different approximation for a particular family, very large family of schemes, which are called explicit schemes. By that we mean, if you're able to write a scheme, which is the one you're going to use to update in time, that has this following shape, some matrix multiplying the unknown state of your field equal to some source that is completely known, and where you can identify this matrix to be diagonal, then formally you can always imagine taking the inverse of this matrix and multiply to the left with the inverse of the metric, and then I can write phi n plus 1 equal to a minus 1 multiplying b. So we can do that explicitly. So let me just say it here. So if a is diagonal, and you have this, and you multiply at the left with a to the minus 1, this gives you the diagonal, the identity matrix, and then you have phi n plus 1 is a to the minus 1 b. That's one particular property that these explicit schemes have, is that you can turn it by assuming that you know everything at the previous enough levels. You can always obtain the next level by a simple direct operation. This is not always the case. There are other types of methods called implicit schemes, which have different properties. And notice that we know that this is diagonal. Simply by observing this, there is nothing in here that couples different values of n plus 1 at n plus 1. We're going to discuss one particular difference in just a few minutes of a different scheme that will be implicit. And because of the difficulties in solving implicit schemes, we're going to make it explicit in some particular way. But let's wait till that. So this is, in the example we discussed yesterday, this is what we were talking about. We introduced these two fields, the value of, let's say, the field psi as being the gradient of the field phi, the field pi as being the time derivative of the field phi, to render it into a first-order system of equations. So now our equations, as we discussed yesterday, turn out to be this way. The time derivatives of the fields are the gradients of the opposite. So this field, the time derivative is coupled to the gradient of the other field and vice versa. And now because we have two first order equations, we just need one condition per field because it's just first order in time. And so we are going to have to define the value of the field, this field at time equal to zero, and the value of this other field at time equal to zero, and that allows us to move forward. So the scheme we just discussed that required three levels, and we were discretizing the original equation in second order form, require us, given phi, two pieces of information for phi, when we change it from a second order system into two first order equations, we just have to give different boundary, different initial conditions, which are interpreted in a different way, but it's the same kind of contact that we had before. Before we would be given the phi, the function phi, and its time derivative. Now we're given the function phi and pi, which is the time derivative. So there is no free lunch. The conservation, there's conservation in the quantities, the amount of quantities that we have to define. So now let's discuss a little bit about these boundaries. And this is, you're going to see a first example of where this information about the characteristics makes a huge difference. So we did the analysis, but we discussed that this equation has characteristics moving to the left and moving to the right that have speed 1. These are the characteristics, and we'll later discuss a general way to understand them, given a general system that you don't know what the characteristics are as opposed to this, which is a very simple system, how you would calculate that in an explicit manner. But let's for the moment assume that we know the characteristics are these left and right moving modes that are going at speed 1. So now, this is a very common scenario. So let me just go back to this example. Suppose you're iterating your equation in some box. And this is what we said yesterday, that is unfortunately something we cannot escape unless we are in a closed space where boundary conditions, periodic boundary conditions can be used. Generically, you're interested in the solution within some domain. So we want to understand within, say, this building or this room, we want to understand the state of the system. But that might be too expensive for us. It might be too difficult to implement in the whatever computer we have available. So we might be content to just saying, okay, I want to solve the problem here. I'm going to put a box that is smaller than the room, and I just want to know, for instance, the temperature of this piece of space here. But unfortunately, we have the real problem we wanted to solve was the one that contained the full room. So what do? We want to make sure that in our smaller computational domain that we are able to discretize, we put boundary conditions that are consistent with the real problem we want to solve. That is, if we really want to solve a problem that is this big, but we can only afford solving that problem, we want to make sure we define boundary conditions here that are as consistent as we can to the problem that we really try to solve. Then we're going to have to, once we have a solution, we're going to have to prove that the boundary conditions we implemented are achieving the desired goal. But for the moment, we're trying to do the best job we can at the very beginning. So let's imagine in this particular case that this real equation we wanted to solve was this wave equation, where boundaries that were going all the way to infinity. Because they go all the way to infinity, in that case, you expect that, okay, if I don't have any sources at infinity, if I do something here, if I put some initial perturbation, that perturbation will propagate away and should never come back because I don't have anything at far distances that will reflect that energy that is going out initially to come back in. And so now is when we say, well, let's try to use that in a practical way to enforce the boundary conditions. And what we're going to say is that, well, we know that the characteristics describe modes that move to the left or modes that move to the right. And this is something we discussed briefly yesterday. So if I concentrate on this boundary, I want to ensure that whatever the field is doing when it gets close to the boundary, it's only moving that way. Moving that way means that any of the fields can be written in as a general combination of some function, let me call it h to be generic, that is t plus x. And that holds true for both phi and pi. So if I assume that phi and pi have this dependence at this boundary, then it has to be true that h comma t has to be equal to h comma x. Do you all see that? So we're using explicitly this assumption that once we get to this boundary, any R dependence or any dependence in T and X have to come in this combination T plus X, because that's what it says to us, that the only thing that is reaching this boundary is something that moves to the left. And if we analyze the same on the right boundary, we're going to have the opposite. Here you want H of T minus X if it's moving to the right, and then we're going to have the opposite, H comma T equal minus H comma X. So we can then turn that observation into the following boundary conditions, which says, okay, and these two, at the left boundary, we want this to be satisfied by phi and pi, and at the right boundary, we want this to be satisfied by phi and pi. Okay, so at this moment, you should be crying again that I'm pulling a quick on you, because I said we have a second order equation. We can only give two pieces of information. How many am I given here in total? If I try to enforce all these conditions. Right, so I am over-specifying the problem. And that I could be in danger of completely screwing up my implementation. We're going to be able to prove, maybe Friday, that even though we're over-specifying the problem, we're doing it in a consistent way, and in reality, we're only just using two pieces of information in disguise. But this is something we're going to discuss later on. So we have to be very careful. I mean, every time you see that you're putting more information than the counting should tell you, be sure that you have a warning sign in the back of your mind if everything goes wrong, that this might be the cause of it. But this is, by the way, what this simple example that of RMPL that we had had in the code. So let me discuss the method that the code used, this Crank-Nicholson method, which was this what we discussed. They're given two levels. We're just going to use two levels, and we're going to imagine that we center everything at the midpoint. And there are two reasons we discuss this method. One is it's particularly simple. It only involves two levels. but it will tie in this discussion of explicit versus implicit schemes. So again, we do exactly the same thing we did before. We just, every time derivative, we can discuss only one of the equations because the other one is the same. We know that the time derivative can be written this way, which approximates the value of the time derivative at the in-between level that doesn't exist, but it doesn't matter. We're pictorially thinking, we're evaluating things there, plus some second-order error in delta t. Therefore, it's also second order in h. The same thing holds true for the space derivative, which, say, if we're doing at level n, we can write it this way. And again, we can convince ourselves that this derivative operator defined in this way is an approximation to the continuous derivative operator up to an error of that goes like delta x squared times the gradient, the third derivative of the field. So again, this is also an approximation of order h squared. We can introduce a further operator, and this is the operator that was called mu in that little script that we saw yesterday, which is just the average operator, and we call it forward in time because we're imagining that we have level time t, and we are going to level n, and we're going to average with the n plus 1, because we could also be averaging with level n minus 1. And so if we define just the average between level n plus 1 and level n, that, again, using the Taylor approximation, we can see that is the value that un has, that u has at level n plus 1 j, at the point j, time an error that, again, is of order delta squared. So this operator mu can be defined in this way, which is the identity times the second derivative, the delta squared times the second derivative of the field, of whatever field we apply it to, evaluated at level n plus a half. So you can show right away that if you apply this, which is now seen as an operator, rather than acting on the function u, acting instead of on the result of the derivative of the field pi, it is a second-order approximation to the derivative of the field pi at the intermediate level evaluated at point j. So give that a try. It's a simple algebraic exercise. But now we can use that to put everything together and realize that if we use this, now we will have an approximation that is second-order accurate to the derivative of the field. And we had that this was a second-order accurate approximation to the time derivative of the field at the intermediate level. So putting these two things together, we get the R scheme, the scheme that we were using yesterday afternoon. And we can write this explicitly, which is this. And this is known as the Kranz-Nicholson scheme, which is a scheme that involves both the new level and the present level together, but it is one where we see the right-hand side depending on n plus 1 as well. So the right-hand side depends on the new level as the left-hand side, and therefore this is not an explicit scheme. We cannot evaluate the value of phi n plus 1 unless we know some extra information about it, which we don't know. So that is now a case where this matrix, so we can still write something of this form. Let me just call it un plus 1. For some set of unknown u's, we can still write it this way, but now this matrix is no longer diagonal. So for instance, if I try to write this or that equation in this form, I could do the following. Let me just schematically say this. So I could say, well, let me imagine that the field u is a combination of the field phi, so at the n plus 1, followed by the field pi, and I can bring to the left-hand side everything that depends on n plus 1, and to the right-hand side, everything that depends on n. Because when we write this, our rule is everything in B has to be something that we know. So then this matrix that we have in, as a result, will be a complicated matrix that has, at some point, say I'm interested at the point J to obtain the value there. So at some point, I have the row that corresponds to J. I will have, I don't know, the value 1, the value 1, which is the factor I have in front of here. But I have other pieces that it will involve P, the slot that will multiply pi. So if I have here phi and then pi, I know that there will be values here and values here and values here that will hit the pi's to produce that particular equation. So now we have a matrix that is much more complicated. It's not just a diagonal. It's not easy to take the inverse. So here is where we have two choices. And depending on which technique one is using, one may be more convenient than the other one. The straightforward, at least in our minds, way to think about it is to say, well, this matrix, I mean, it might not be easy to find the inverse, but it should have an inverse if I'm defining if I have a well-defined problem. So I could work hard to compute the inverse, or I can have a code to compute the inverse for us. That's fine, but depending on the dimensionality of our problem, especially if we're doing three dimensions, this could be extremely costly, and we want to avoid doing this. So what we could do instead is to just generate an iterative approach where we try to get the inverse in an approximate fashion. And this is the one we used yesterday, which was to say, well, I'm going to do it in a different way. I'm going to assume that I iterate this one, but I do it in an iterative manner. So I leave everything that is on the right-hand side in the right-hand side. I will never move it from there. And I'm going to iterate. I'm going to pay the price of just, at every given time step, iterate in time. And so what we start with is, initially, we set this value of pi at the new level. We set it equal to the value of pi at the old level. So it's just a first-order approximation. We drop it from second order to first order. But then we just iterate. So what we would do is obtain, well, we're iterating the R equation next to it. We obtain phi n plus 1 and pi n plus 1 by iterating the two equations. We take these as trial functions. We then put it back to the right-hand side, and we keep iterating. And consequently, as a consequence, we're going to get a sequence of phi n plus 1 and pi n plus 1. And as you said before, we can establish a tolerance that whenever the difference between two successive iterations is below some error, we're fine, we're happy with what the quality of the solution, and then we move forward. Okay, so this is what we did, and this, so this is what the code you ran yesterday was doing. We're going to introduce a little bit of a more abstract notation. This is what we get for the particular equation we're talking about, but there was nothing special about that equation. We can always imagine we have a set of equations. Let's imagine they're written this way. U, t equals to some operator of acting on u. For instance, let me just... And this, the reason why we're introducing this notation is because it's going to make general discussions a lot simpler. So first, I can imagine that, so I claim that we can always think any system in that way. So in particular, if I have where u can be a vector of unknowns. So let me give you an example. We can imagine u to be the vector phi pi, and L is a vector of operators. And again, I'm not saying exactly what operators are, but if I define my u vector being this way and my L vector being, for this particular case, phi comma x, I can see here exactly the equation we just got, exactly the equation we were just dealing with. So we can imagine a general, an arbitrary large number of unknowns or dependent variables that we're trying to solve, and this L might be a complete mess. But formally, we can always write it that way. And what we'll see when we write Einstein's equations, for instance, is that we'll have the metric sitting here, and this L will be a complicated operator that actually involves, so in here, I have L only dealing with pi in for the equation for u, for phi dot, sorry, and only dealing with phi for the equation for pi dot, but in Einstein's equations, we're going to have everything mixed. And so this could be as complicated as we want, but we're going to be able to keep most of our discussion completely general and agnostic with respect to the problem that we're dealing with. So we're going to be able to make generic statements. Yes, but we need to introduce a few more concepts. Yes, definitely. But first, we need to understand how do we even begin to think about that. So we're going to get to that. So the generic Kranz-Nicholson scheme will be to write this one using our basic knowledge here, or a basic observation in this way. So we're saying, okay, the left-hand side is simple enough. It's just a time derivative. So we can approximate it to second order in this way. On the right-hand side, we're going to say, well, it's the average of the operator evaluated at un plus 1 and the operator evaluated at un. And notice I have also included a superindex h. With this is the discretization of the real operator we have here. Again, just as here, for instance, if we look at this one, the L is the analytical or the closed form expression for our equation, which was the partial derivative of pi with respect to x. But we need to approximate that as well. We need to discretize it. So we will never put, we will never be using L. Instead, we will be using some discrete version of L, which is L sub h. And these are now we're going to discuss some of the things we have to worry about in how we're going to define these and how we're going to interpret the solution we obtain. So that's what we're going for now after we add a few things. So let me just remind you a few of the things we had in the code yesterday. If we have boundaries, we have to make sure that we define the derivative operators towards the boundaries correctly, because we might not be able to have those points. And these are the forward and backward derivative operators that you saw in this RMPL script. And then again, so just you can do this exercise to convince yourself that everything is consistent as we said here. Just for completeness, then the code was implemented in these equations at the left and right boundaries for the equation phi and something analog for equation for pi. And these are the initial data that we had to define. And so I would say just play around by choosing different values of sigma, the 0, 1, and minus 1, and you'll see that in one case something moved to the right or to the left, or you have this splitting. Yesterday we were choosing sigma equals 0 when we saw it split in half. Okay, so now it's where we really want to go to the discussion I wanted to get to. So now this is more of a conceptual discussion and a philosophical way of approaching this, which is the right way of understanding how things are going in your approximation. So we're going to consider that we have some PDEs to solve. We're going to solve and find a different approximation. And what we are interested, of course, is in the continuum limit. Our equations, what we write, our theories are continuum equations, generically, unless we were doing quantum stuff, in which case a discrete representation might come as representing the system. But we're going to stay at the classical level. Therefore, we have to worry about the continuous equations. And we have introduced a completely ad hoc and artificial discretization. This is something we chose. And two different persons in this room might choose two different ways of doing that. And both will have to worry about the same thing. Make sure that one can prove that when h, the discretization length, goes to 0, we recover the right solution. Two people will recover the same solution. And if they don't, they can have enough tests out there to find out who is right and who is not. OK, so we expect that if everything went well, we're going to be able to show that the error in our solution goes to zero as its discretization goes to zero. But now we need to introduce the right tools or the right concepts to test this out. So we're going to let us introduce some notation. We're going to assume that we have this problem. Some operator acting on u equal to some source. So this is now slightly more involved than this one. I mean, imagine that now, let me just consider that I have this L, which is generically, it would be kind of d dt minus some R operator. Let me call this script L. And we might be trying to solve LU equal an F. The reason we keep this general, and I'm not writing this as dt, is because everything we argue here will be applicable to any of the equations, any type of equation, not necessarily just the hyperbolic type of equations that we were dealing with. It could be elliptic, it could be parabolic, it could be even Schrodinger equation. The concepts we're going to introduce now are completely generic, and they are applicable to any discrete solution that you may have. So imagine that this L contains partial derivatives. It's acting on some unknown dependent variables, might have some driving source defined again in closed form, or fed in by some approximation, and we want to find the solution u as a function of time. And let's say for simplicity, we're also going to stick to one dimension for the time being. But this is totally general. Okay, so now our goal is to treat this problem and obtain an approximation that we can control. We know how good it is to that equation. Of course, all this is continuum, say, so now we have to introduce a discretization, a discrete version of all this in order to solve, to be able to put it in the computer. So just as we did before, we're going to assume that we find a way, and this is going to be something we have complete freedom of defining a discrete version of the operator L. There's going to be a discrete analog of LH. And again, let me just, for simplicity, and to fix ideas, let me imagine that if L is, say, d dx, L sub H could be of u is um u at j plus 1 minus u at j minus 1 divided by 2 delta x. So that would be the L, that would be the LH. Again, this is unique. This is what we get from the partial differential equations we're trying to solve. This is completely arbitrary. This is something we chose to do in a particular way. If we chose to use finite differences, this is one way of representing the derivative. But if we want to do higher order, we might be able to involve further points of u and have something that converges more rapidly to that guy. So this is where our personal choices come in. We're going to be solving, as I said, a different system. We had the partial differential equations at the continuum level. We introduced a discretized version. And there is, as a result, we're going to obtain a discrete solution, which we're going to denote with UH. Our job is to make sure that we can ensure that this UH is going to be a well-defined approximation to this U, which is what we're after. So we're going to have this notation where now, because we're going to keep the discussion general, remember we're putting n as a supra-index to denote time. Because this is completely general, we're just putting h to denote the discrete version of the continuous problem that we're trying to solve. So we're going to define the concept of a residual. So let me just introduce or discuss a little bit, and then we're going to introduce that definition at the very end of this transparency. This is the problem that we're going to be solving at a discrete level, or at least formally, this is the problem we're trying to solve at the discrete level. The discrete operator that approximates our partial derivative operator operating on the discrete solution minus the discrete version of the source is equal to zero. That is the problem we solve in the explicit fashion. Unless we don't introduce any other approximation, that's a problem we solve always. However, in some cases, it might be very difficult to find this UH just because the solution of this problem might be too complicated. For instance, if this problem were just simply some matrix multiplying by UH equal to FH, we might have a matrix here that is very difficult to invert. And so we might introduce an approximation to the matrix, and as a result, we might end up with a solution that is not exactly zero, but it's just an approximation to this discrete solution that we would obtain if we were solving this problem exactly. Right? Do you all follow me? So in the example, for instance, of the Kranz-Nicholson scheme, we were introducing an approximation. We were solving this equation only approximately. And the approximation was that epsilon value that we used to just say how far we were going to go in the iteration till we were happy with that particular solution. So we have, rather than UH, we might have a scenario solution, which is U tilde H, which is an approximation to the true solution UH. And so we're going to define this concept of a residual, which is the L that we really want to, that we really have defined, the L supra H, acting on this U tilde H, which is the approximation to the true discrete solution UH minus FH. And this residual, and because it depends on the discretization and how we're doing things, we're also going to put it a supra index H. So we're going to define, or we now are bringing the concept that we'll have a convergent process, as which is a convergent iterative process, which will converge if this residual goes to zero. So in the limit that we have done, that we iterated enough, this UH, U tilde H, will approximate this UH arbitrarily well, and we're going to be able to drive this residual to zero. This is both point-wise and global-wise. So, I mean, we're always going to take the stricter possible way, which is the point-wise, because you can have something that is converging very well in a global norm, but at a given point, it's just not doing well enough, and so it's not going to be a good enough solution. So let me define another concept. Again, all these concepts will come in combined in just a few minutes, which is a concept of truncation error, and this is something we have already been discussing. We define the truncation error as the value that we will get if we have the exact closed form solution, the solution we started trying to get to begin with, and we use it to evaluate now how the operator, the discrete operator, acts on that solution minus the discrete version of the function. That is, if someone knows the solution by hand and gives it to you, and you just want to evaluate the discrete operation that you're applying to obtain a solution, you're not going to obtain a zero. You only obtain a zero if you put UH, which was the solution to this problem. Now, I give you another solution. In particular, I give you the exact solution. If you evaluate this, this is what you're going to get. Right? This is the truncation error. And again, our goal will be to demonstrate that this truncation error actually goes to zero as this H goes to zero. Remember, H was the control parameter. And the form of the truncation error, how this value converges as H goes to zero, this is something we can always compute just by the difference in approximation. And this is something we've done. When we replaced that derivative by this derivative, we could calculate that the error was proportional to h squared, and in particular had to do with this, the third derivative of the function u. Okay, so now this is the most intuitive concept of all, which is to say, well, we're going to define the solution converges if and only if, as we this make this control parameter go to zero, the solution goes to u. Of course, this is going to be very difficult to assess in general because we really don't know what that solution is, and that's the reason we're working hard. If we knew the solution, we wouldn't be doing this problem. So what we're after now is try to obtain or define the right steps to guarantee that this will take place. So there's theorems that backs us up in that if you can say a lot of things about UH, how it behaves, then you're going to be guaranteed that in the limit you recover u. So the very first thing we need to say is to introduce something that a concept called consistency. We're going to say that our approximation, this LH that we obtain, and the whole solution of the problem will be consistent with the problem at hand if we can prove that this truncation error goes to zero as H goes to zero. And that's going to be very easy to compute because we can always evaluate this TH in an appropriate fashion. A little extra twist or addition into that, we're going to say that something converges, our code converges with a given order, if we can prove that the truncation error goes to zero as H goes to zero in this particular fashion, that is the control parameter to some given power. And of course, the higher the power, the more accurate the solution will be for a given H. I mean, let me just say, stress why we're wondering too much about this. Especially in discovery mode, when you're trying to solve a problem where you don't really have a good intuition, it's very hard to look at the solution and say, this solution is right. This is, I should say, is perhaps most relevant for our purposes, numerical relativity. As we'll discuss tomorrow, Einstein's equations have 2 degrees of freedom, but they are extremely hidden in the variable we have. We have the metric at our disposal. It has 10 values, 10 coefficients at every given point, but only 2 are physically carrying degrees of information. If I tell you the metric is doing this, you have no idea where it makes sense or not. Astrophysicists, on the other hand, typically they don't worry that much about this. And if they would show you results and they say, well, this is probably correct, and then you go, how do you know it's correct? Have you checked convergence? And they would go, what are you talking about? And the reason is they don't worry that much is because in those, typically you have a good feeling for the solution. You're dealing with physical variables. They are dealing with the density of a star, the velocity of fluid, or the velocity of the fluid that describes the star. Nevertheless, the literature is filled with results that were later modified or improved by doing even more detailed simulations, and then realizing that some of the solutions were found before had a spurious mode simply because they were driven by errors. So, but in unfortunately, in the area of numerical relativity, where you see a solution and you don't really have a good feeling of where that is correct, where some of the things you're seeing are coordinate issues, etc., this being very careful with these concepts actually is very important. Okay, we're also going to define this solution error, EH, which is the difference between the solution we want to obtain minus the discrete solution we obtain for any given value of H. Of course, this is a priori something that you say, well, how do we even know this if the only thing we have access to is a solution we're obtaining, but not that one? Well, we're going to argue that you can actually obtain EH, or at least a form of EH, even when you don't really know what the solution truly is. It is common to assume that if you can prove the truncation error of your code converges to zero with order HP, the solution will converge with exactly the same fashion. This assumption is often true, but one has to make sure that one has taken the right steps to guarantee that this showing this will be equivalent to showing that. Okay, so just to wrap up, everything we're going to say and discuss is generic. It doesn't just only apply to the problems, the hyperbolic problems we're going to be talking about. This kind of reasoning you can apply to any discrete solution. And again, as I said before, it's very, very important that one performs convergence studies to make sure that the solution is correct. So let me just do one simple analysis in a case where we can solve the problem completely, and then we're going to try to peel off from it and make discussions that are generic even when we cannot solve the problem. So let's just imagine that we have just simply this equation. The time derivative of the function of the field u is equal to some parameter times the space derivative of the function u. We have one first order equation. Therefore, we can only give one initial condition. So we're going to give as initial condition the shape of the field at t equal to zero. we're going to define the things in between space coordinates that goes from 0 to 1. But for simplicity, we're going to assume that this problem is periodic. So if something goes to the right, it should come back exactly in the same way to the from the left. And because we're assuming periodic boundary condition, we really don't have to give boundary conditions. It's implicit in just enforcing periodicity. So the solution to this problem is trivial, and we have been using it, essentially, when we have discussed the characteristics. The solution, the general solution to this problem will be given by just a translation of the initial shape defined in the initial data to the right or left, depending on the value of A, this to the left, in this way. So the solution U at any given point, at any given time, is equal to the initial value that we specify, having shifted the initial profile in this way. And this function mod is a function that will just wrap around the spatial domain between 0 and 1 and make it just stay in 0 and 1. So now we can do, because we know what the solution is, we can go over all the steps that we discuss, but then and evaluate some of these things explicitly, but then we'll argue how you're going to do it in general. Because in general, you're not going to be able to solve the full problem. And what we want to say is that the error, this E sub H, will be in principle computable if we can opt from the solution UH that we are obtaining. And again, at the point that we want to drive home is that one can always analyze enough the solutions obtained to be able to, at the end of the day, say, this is the solution that solves this problem, and these are the error bars I'm obtaining. So let's complete this, the analysis of this problem. We're solving the problem u, t equal a u, x. So let's introduce our, by now, well-known approximation. So for instance, for the space derivative, we do it this way. We're going to assume we're going to do this leapfrog scheme, and so we're doing this three-level schemes and introducing this time derivative to be the difference between two levels, the one to the future and the one to the past. Again, these are the relationships for the spacing in time and space. And what we're going to be doing is assuming that we use our discrete operators acting with the solution that should be the one we are trying to get, and then expand things out so as to obtain a good analysis of what the solutions are, or the errors are. So let me just go over it again, using the definitions we introduced. So we can prove, and this is what we do with the Taylor approximation, that this derivative operator that we introduced before, just the difference between the value to the right and the value to the left divided by twice the spacing between the two of them, approximates this discrete derivative, is an approximation. Now, as we're going kind of backwards, we say these discrete operators can be approximated at the continued level by the exact continued operator plus this error term plus terms of higher order. Right? So you see that? So this is exactly using what we did before. You can use the Taylor approximation, assuming that everything is continuous to the right, to find out that if you take this difference, what you obtain is that that difference can be written this way in the continuous fashion. Analogously, the time derivative has exactly the same behavior. And now here would be a delta t squared, but we have delta t being lambda h. So then it's lambda squared h squared. So for our solution, we have different quantities. Or for our all the solutions we can compute, we have different quantities we can evaluate. So for the continuous solution, acting with the continuous operator and having the continuous driving function, this is true. The solution to this problem is equivalent to the solution of the problem we had. In this particular case, the partial derivative minus A, the spatial derivatives acting on U equals 0. For the discrete problem, the problem we're solving would be the discrete version of this problem, and we have the discrete solution, which is in this case, so we would have the discrete time derivative minus A, the discrete space derivative, acting on the discrete solution is equal to 0. So this is the problem we solve. This is the problem we wanted to solve. And this is something we can evaluate. This is the, what I say, the truncation error, is that if for a moment we imagine that this solution is at our disposal, we know the continuous solution, we can always evaluate what the discrete operator acting on the continuous solution minus the discrete function would give us, and this is what we call the truncation error. So we can see what happens if we put u in here. This is a continuous function. We know precisely what dt and dx are with respect to continuous operators. So we can always prove that this, which is the equivalent to that one, is equal to that term plus higher order terms. Do you all see that? And so now is where we're going to argue that then what we can do is, armed with this one, use a very one key observation of finite difference that was done by Richardson in the 20s, or 1920s. In his goal, what he was trying to do is just make use of formal results, or be able to develop formal results for two generic approximations. And in 1920s, there weren't computers where he could run his simulations. He was just thinking from the very formal point of view. That means that, again, this is something that is important. Sometimes people take computational or numerical solutions as kind of a poorer child of analytical work. Richardson was working on applied analysis, and this theory comes all the way from that time. And so the statements that we're going to make are completely general. They are true, but we're going to assume that we're using a uniform mesh with the scale parameter h, and we're centering things. If we're not doing things, then we have to extend or enlarge our analysis a little bit, but this is the simplest one. So Richardson observed that if you satisfy this two structure, regardless of the problem you're dealing with, it could be linear, it could be nonlinear, it could be a combination of variables, et cetera, you can show that the solution you're obtaining for any given discretization length is related to the true solution you want to obtain, the closed form solution, with this kind of approximation. So UH is equal to U, the function you want to obtain, plus H squared, some smooth and well-behaved error, plus H to the fourth times our solution. So what you say is, my discrete solution can be approximated by an expansion whose zeroth order expansion is the solution I want, and everything else are terms that are governed by h to some given power multiplying some continuum solution. This observation will come in handy in what we're trying to do. Yes? Well, yeah, this is your control parameter, the h squared. And the important thing is that notice that these functions, all this e2, e4, et cetera, everything I'm writing here is independent on this h. So they are pre-multiplied by factors that depend on the discretization length, but the solutions, the terms themselves, are completely independent. That observation will let us manipulate things in a very useful way.
Is there a simple justification why there should be only
one part of h? Remember when we did this analysis, every time we introduced the derivatives, and we always saw this. This is because of we chose a centered scheme. If it's not centered, then you have all the other terms. But so we're going to assume centered for our discussion, and you'll see that everything we say will extend, except that some of the simple calculations will just add, will have a little bit of an extra complication, but that's it. Okay, so we're going to use that observation explicitly, and this is what you just discussed. If we just don't use a center, or we drop to first order schemes, then you're going to have that H. The other case, by the way, this was applicable for a second order scheme. Okay. So what we can do is to say, let's analyze again, and for simplicity, let me just drop this F, because it's just some driving source. It really doesn't add anything to the discussion. Let's use that observation by Richardson that we can write UH as U plus H squared E, etc., in this equation. The discrete version of L acting on the discrete solution equal to zero implies the following. So this is what we put for the operators, the discrete version. This is what the solution would look like. So we could put UH, or we can put U plus H squared, E2, et cetera. So we know that this difference can be written, or this can be approximated. Now, each one of these can be approximated in the continuous side of things by this operator for dt. And notice I'm only keeping the leading order term up to here. This derivative operator, this combination of continuous derivative operators approximate the discrete derivative operators, and then a bunch of other terms which have higher order of h, acting on this u plus h squared e, etc. The important thing is what we're saying is that this that is purely discrete can be reinterpreted as a much larger system that has purely continuous function and continuous operators. So now what we could do is act this equation or these operators on this solution, which is now purely continuous. It just has this h every now and then, but everything is continuous in front as far as it depends in space and time, and just match every single power of h that we can find. So the first power, which is the one that has no powers of h, just says dt minus a dx is equal of u is equal to 0. So this is just a statement of consistency that says that the problem we're trying to address, or we're addressing at the discrete level, contains at the zeroth order, essentially at the h equal to 0 limit, the equation we really wanted to solve. So this is just to justify that the solution we'll obtain here, when we take h equal to 0, will be precisely the equation we wanted to solve. We can go to the next order and say, well, what do we get at order h squared? Well, at order h squared, we get the following. Time derivative minus a dx of this function e2, which is this the error that comes at leading order, is equal to 1/6 a third derivative of x, third derivative of time, in this way, acting on u. If we imagine that u is a given function, the one we obtain, this can be interpreted as a source. And so we can see this, the second order or the next order in the equation as being as determining e2, given that we know u. And we can keep going. We can find what an equation for e4, e6, e8, etc. And this is what I said early on. We can prove rigorously, and this is what we're doing now, that the original equation, L u of f, which contains one solution, is equivalent or is turns into, in the discrete and the discrete domain, into a series of equations that defines for us every single term in the approximation. So now we can say, well, let's keep going at this very specific example and say, well, let's solve for E2 in this very simple example of the wave equation or of this advection equation. We can even solve it in closed form. One natural condition, so we are trying to solve, again, for this problem, which is a purely analytical problem, we're going to assume that this is known because we know the solution u. Let's ask the question, what is E2 going to be like? Well, what is the initial condition for E2? Well, it better be that our initial conditions are perfect. That means that we are not making any error at the initial time. I want to know what is going to be the function E at a later time. And it's a simple exercise in PDE. Given this equation, this is a source now. Remember, u we obtained because we could solve this problem in closed form. To solve this equation, and let me just give you the answer. The answer will say that E2 is some function multiplied by a linear term containing time. So it's time times that. Which says, even though you iterated equations with second order accuracy, the error will be grown with time to leading order. That means that, and this is something we always want to assess, how does the error behave? If the error were to grow in an uncontrolled way, it will just completely render our solution to be garbage after a short time. Or what we would have is that this error or the solution deteriorates with time, because errors just compound, and this is what is going on here. Errors are compounding, adding themselves, and growing in a linear fashion. So understanding the error behavior is going to be important to for us to understand where things are making sense or not. So we can see, and this is kind of the bottom line, we can see the final different approximation to the partial differential equation we started with as just a hierarchy of PDEs that defines every single term in the Richardson expansion. So let me just say a few things about this and then we can wrap up. So of course, in general, we are not able to do this analysis. We're not able to find what the true solution is that, that we're trying to get and assess what the different values of the errors are. However, we can do a pretty good job at understanding what these errors are and even manipulating them in such a way that we can obtain something that is much more accurate than we began with. So I'll let you read these notes on your own, and then we're going to discuss a little bit. But first, I want to show better an example. So how you go about doing these things at the ground level. So we're going to use explicitly that UH, the value that the discrete function we obtain for some given value of H, can be written as a continuous solution. And let me just ignore the dependencies. Plus some H squared times E2 plus H4, E4, etc. And let's see how we can take this observation to our advantage to guarantee that our solution is well behaved. So suppose we only have to do some work. Instead of knowing the solution, as I said before, generically we don't know the solution. That's the reason why we're doing this work. But we could do something that will amount to us being able to say a lot about this expansion. So suppose we iterate the equation with some value of h, and we do it for several values, uh h, u2h, u4h, etc., for some resolution. So we're imagining that this is kind of the finest resolution, where the separation between points is h, this is 2h, this is 4h, and so on. And we also assume that we have arranged things, and this is important why we're doing the h, 2h, 4h, that in one case we have, say, 4h, these are the grid points. In 2h, we have those grid points. And in 4h, oh, sorry, in h, we have these grid points. The point being that there are points that are common to all grids. And then it would make sense for us to take the difference between two of them. So let us just see what the difference will give you. So this is what we're getting. Using Richardson's observation, we say, well, UH should behave that way. U2H should behave that way. And this is why it's very important that our analysis say that every single function here is completely independent of the discretization link. The only place where the discretization link appears is in these factors. So that means U2H goes like that, U4H goes like that. And now we can do a few things. So let us do, for instance, the following. Suppose we take the difference of U4H minus U2H. So I take the difference of this one minus that one. When I do that, the unknown U drops out. Everything else will be there because now we have different factors. But the important thing is that the next leading order, this 2H, we're going to have a factor here, another factor here, multiplied by the norm of E2. This is some absolute value, say, or some norm over the whole space, whichever way we prefer. And the good thing is that the next leading order will have something that will simplify the E2s, assuming that h is sufficiently small that all this drops out in front of, or when compared with these terms. And when we do that, when we obtain the result of this for a second order code, we obtain a number. And it's just 4. Right? So let me just do that. So we had UH was U plus H squared plus E2. Let me just ignore everything else. U2H is U plus 4H squared E2. And U4H is U plus 16 H squared E2. So if I take the difference of these two, or I want these two, I have h square e2 minus h fourth h, sorry, 4 h square e2 divided by 4 h square e2 minus 16 h square e2. So I can take out the h's, the h square as a common factor. I can simplify the e2's, and if I do it in the right way, I get a factor 4 of 1/4, depending on how you order things. So if you do coarser minus mid resolution minus fine resolution, you get a 4. What it did there was exactly the opposite. So just, if you just do it the right way, you either get a 4 or the 1/4. Furthermore, once you convince yourself that this is true, that you are getting second order convergence, you can keep pushing it. And you say, well, let me take the difference of these two. I can, again, assume that the orders that it goes like h to the fourth are very small compared to the orders h squared. And I can use this. We're not going to do that explicitly, but you can convince yourself that now I can use the difference of these two consecutive solutions to actually obtain a good approximation to my error function. And you can gauge how big the answer is. And we can do even something else. Having obtained what E2 is, I can say, well, if I know what E2 is, I can now turn it around and use it to completely eliminate it. So let me see what happens if I define this way. Suppose I define this new value, u bar h, and I say, let me define to be 4uh minus u2h divided by 3. Why do I do that? Well, if you do that particular combination using explicitly what we know, what I'm doing is I'm using explicitly that I know what h square, that I have an h square here and I have a 4 there, and I combine the particular factors so that at the end of the day, two things cancel. Not only u cancels, but also, here there is, sorry, no, this is wrong. U will not cancel, so I have 4u minus u, that's 3u. There is a typo here, it should be u. So I'm going to get a u here as a leading order term, but the e2 will completely wipe out. I have 4e2 divided by, well, 4e2 minus 4e2, they will drop. Yeah, I'm going to close now. And so I'm able to knock down the term that goes like h squared, and I can now have an overall error that is h to the fourth. So we didn't do any extra work. We wrote a second order code. We run the equation, say, three times, the code three times. We are able to assess the convergence of our code. And all of a sudden, we're able to get an error that is much accurate, much smaller than the one we initially planned out simply by using the observation that we have. So we're going to stop here, but let me, before that, I want to show you one example, which is the one you had for your code. So let me just, and how you use XVS. So XVS is able to get most of these things for you. So this is the code we have yesterday. When I ran it, I ran four different resolutions, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, every time doubling the number of points. So let me just, hopefully by now everyone has XVS working. So let me open it. And I want to go here. And let me send all the PPs in here. So I have 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. I can do a bunch of things. I can take differences. For instance, I can say take this one minus that one. So I do x2 minus I, and I say 1 minus 2. So I click this one, that one, and it produces that difference for me. Let me just see one thing. Remember, these values in here are the values of how big your function is. So my function was as big as 1 in 3 and 4. When I take the difference, notice what I get. The error is 10 to the minus 3. So we went all the way 3 orders of magnitude down when we had that particular resolutions, the ones that are between 3 and 4. most importantly, something I can do. Let me heal this one. XVS has this thing. So if you go in here, there is a, in the options in the menus, there is one that says apply XN, which is operations to all your data. And in particular, something that was written in here by Han is something that said, well, it will test the convergence test for all of them. It has first order convergence, second order convergence, or any convergence that you want. Let me try this one to see what we get. So it doesn't do a great job as renaming this, but it put this extra thing because it's, that's a, PP4 is the last one we work with, and it puts this little bar to say, well, this is the derived thing. Let me just advance a little bit. So what this, is, what this one has done was the following. Takes two consecutive solutions. It subtracts the two of them. And in order to put everything in the same screen, it multiplies by the appropriate factor to try to get everything to scale. So let me just tell you. If I take the difference between this one and that one, so I got UH minus U2H, this one scales like 4H squared minus 3H squared, that's 3H squared E2, right? If I take this one, now I have U4H minus U2H is 16 minus 4 is 12, and so on. So what it does is, using that fact, it multiplies, say, if I want to put these two together, I can multiply this one by 12 and that one by 3, and I can put things. And if we have something that's exactly order 2, all these curves should line up. Assuming, of course, that the terms that go like I h to the fourth are sufficiently small that can be neglected. So this is what you have through the all sequence. We have 5 different values, 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so this one, you can see the number of points that you see tell you where they were a coarse or fine resolution. For instance, the blue has a lot more points than these kind of purple ones. And so this one doesn't align too well. But at the same, but the very fact that they are in the same screen, that fit in the same screen, tells you that they are rather consistent. This one also doesn't fit quite well, but notice what we have in the last two. They're pretty much on top of each other. So they are scaling as expected for a second order code. So that's to compare this in the right way. Let me just kill this one. This is the last thing I want to show you. Suppose we were totally naive and we thought that we have a much better convergence test code. Sorry. Oh. Let me just send this again. Suppose oh, what happened? Let me start it. This is the last thing I promise. Okay, so let me bring this again. This is just to show you how handy this thing is. Suppose you think that your convergence is higher. So we're going to say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Let's say our convergence error, we thought it was order 4, or let's say order 5. So now it gives me this. What did it do? Okay, so let me do this 5. Okay, so now it assumes that the convergence was order 5. That means it starts with h to the 5 rather than h squared. If we look at the same thing, the output now, obviously there is nothing consistent here. I mean, some are huge, some are small. You don't see any trend of things being consistently scaled. So you could use this convergence test checking and try, do I get first order, second order, third order, et cetera. And if you knew that you wrote a second order, well, you should be obtaining a second order accurate. But you can check And if in the previous one, things did not exactly line up, but you can see that as soon as you miss it, you're way off from that convergence, you don't get anything that looks consistent. So this is something you're going to use in your tests and in your homework. Do test what the convergence is looking like. Make sure that you can even ask questions like, well, what is the difference of these two, as we did before? So let me just do it again. I can do 1 minus 2. So I pick 1, 2. So at that, you can even say, well, give me the norm so I can have, I don't have to look at time. So, and this is the error. This is the L2 norm of the difference of the two. So this is what we see. The largest value it got is 10 to the minus 3, so 1,000 times smaller than our initial signal. So the relative error is just 1 per 1,000. It grows for a while, and then it drops. So whenever you see a feature in the solution, try to see if you can make an argument for it. Remember what our code did. It had the initial pulse. The pulse goes through the boundaries, and then it goes away, and we never see it again. That's what happens here. It drops out, and essentially you have zero afterwards because we don't have any signal. Anyway, so these are things. Just play around with XGS. Ask me or ask Dennis as much as you want. The important thing is once you get a solution, you convince yourself that it's right. What we have argued here is for some methods or some techniques that you can use to check that your code is convergent. We still haven't said anything about where the solution, how you check that the solution you obtain is the correct one, because you could be converging to the wrong solution. And that's what we're going to talk a little bit tomorrow. But then quickly, we're going to get into Einstein's equations. We're going to discuss how you address Einstein's equations in general, what are the issues that you have to face, and towards Friday, we're going to come back a little bit to be a little bit more formal on this. You have a question? No, okay, sorry. Yeah, sorry for being too long, but I wanted to make sure you have the basic tools so that you can begin thinking about the homeworks or playing better with KXVS. Thank you.